And welcome back. Another remarkably important conversation with Clifford Carnicom about the aerosol spraying, the poisoning, the toxifying of our atmosphere. And it continues on and on it goes. I looked up this evening, Clifford, at twilight, and there were long spread out spray trails, and amongst them were two jets right out of your control group, just moving right along, doing the normal thing, flying through these long, long 50, 60, 70 mile long trails that had spread out hours ago.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of activity over these last few weeks with dramatic differences in terms of the conditions, not the conditions, but in the result,
right,
even though the conditions are relatively similar.
Agreed. All right. Moving right along, then.
Well, I wanted to thank you for delaying the discussion on global warming to this hour, because I wanted to do this justice. And when we finish with this subject, you know, whenever we have these interviews, I always worry that we have too much time available, and then once we get into them, I always...
Never enough.
Yeah, I never have enough, but I'm going to try to be fair. We'll get through at least some of these items on the list. But I'll talk about this global warming issue for a bit, and then after that, I want to bring up a NASA article that was brought to my attention through participants at the message board, and I also want to give the folks credit that do that. I don't have time to respond, but I do read it. They made a call notice, so a very interesting paper, and we'll talk about that after this. On this global warming issue, what has bothered me is that I have noticed what appears to be an agenda. I'm not sure if that's the case, but it certainly appears to be an agenda of promulgation of the notion that this pollution, basically, that is being introduced into our skies, that has altered our skies, that there's just somehow it has to be protecting us, somehow it has to be helping us, and it must have to do with global warming.
Yeah.
And this stuff is cooling down the earth. And I've been disturbed by the attention that has been given on the airwaves towards promoting that standpoint, that viewpoint, without really any real basis that I can see. And if you look back at my history, the first paper I wrote on this goes back to April of 2002, and the title of that paper was Drought Inducement. And that was the first paper where I was simply asking the question honestly from my own perspective and point of analysis as to what would one expect to happen if you were introducing materials into the atmosphere and you could with reasonable certainty identify the nature of those materials as metallic salts, what would be the expected result? And that paper was the first time that I basically went out on pure analysis and observation and study of physical models. And the early work said that, you know, this idea of global warming, it's not fitting. Now, it seems to be getting a lot of attention on the airwaves. And the reason I am concerned about this, it looks like there's a good chance that it will be used more. And so I want to alert the audience and the listeners that it is possible that we may continue to hear basically the promotion of the idea that somehow, if this is happening, that it is for our betterment in some way, that it's likely tied in with mitigating global warming. But, you know, we don't need to go into the details, and there's no need for public discussion on the subject.
You know that very thing is already in one school textbook. That very concept is being introduced to young people.
You're correct. This is out there, and that's why I'm calling attention to it, because it looks like it is going to be used with increasing frequency, this notion. And yet, the work that I have done says that this is not the case. This is not what is happening. And we may have a classic cover story, you know, that has been proposed to basically try and keep this issue contained within a certain box to make people feel good about things. But my work started in 22, and at that point, the physics of what was going on was saying, you know, that doesn't look right. It looks like this stuff would actually heat things up. And then that was in April 2002. The next one was in January 2004, and it was somewhat of a further progression, and it was starting to make the case that, well, we can show theoretically why it would heat it up, And it's based upon the issue of what's called specific heat. Mm-hmm. And everything heats up at a different rate if you subject it to energy. It heats up. It's an important physical property, what they call the specific heat. And air has a specific heat, and water has a specific heat, and every substance has a specific heat. And it's an expression of how much energy. If you put a certain amount of energy into something, how much it will heat up. To give you just a rough idea, water will take four times as much energy to heat up the same amount as air would. That's why water is such a great cooler. You know, if you want to cool a plant, you put water in. You don't soak it up. Mm-hmm. You add moisture.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything has its own specific heat, and the specific heat of the particular items that have been evaluated and examined have a specific heat, which is actually even quite unusual. Barium in particular will heat up the most of just about anything out there. It really, I'm not going to say it's the leader, but it's in a class of materials that would heat up especially easily. And the physical analogy that I'll make here as we go along tonight, which is suggested by a friend of mine, which I think is helpful, and that is the idea of cooking a baked potato. What do you do? You wrap it in foil. You know, and why do you wrap it in foil? Because that metal will conduct the heat better.
And what kind of foil do you use?
Yeah, you use aluminum in that case. And you know, I'll also go ahead and make that point right now, and I'm not disputing that result. I just simply want to always be clear on my work. I know that there are many folks that at least claim or identify that aluminum is a primary constituent here. It may be. I'm certainly aware of some environmental tests. You know, Rosalind Peterson has done some real good work on their water quality where aluminum is showing up, and he also had some in Canada like that. I simply want to make it clear on my side that my research has actually never I have tests that identifies that material in any unusual sense. And there are some questions about the physical properties of aluminum versus the properties of class 1 and class 2 elements of the periodic table, which is where my work has focused upon.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't deny it. I'll just simply say for those people that attribute that finding to me, that's not actually the case. But the analogy is there, and the analogy is the same. Most metals will heat up certainly more easily than air. So, you know, a theoretical, proposition was made at that time in 2004 that such a thing would be expected to happen. What has bothered me over the years is that at some point I would like to manifest that work into an actual model that could give us some type of actual quantitative estimate. I mean, an actual working model that could give us some idea as to how much would it actually heat up the atmosphere.
Hmm.
Now, that's not a real easy, you know, problem for me to work with, and that's why it's been sitting for a couple years. The theoretical basis was there, but you're dealing with, mixtures is what you're dealing with, mixtures of materials. And so I've sat on it for a couple years, but that's what I wanted to talk tonight about, was that I have created such a model. Models are just that. They're simply a representation of reality. They're not reality. They are an attempt to represent reality in a way that we can understand. Mm-hmm. Every model has limitations, weaknesses, and faults. But nevertheless, the model is my attempt, based on what I regard as sound physical principles, primarily those of the use of specific heat of mixtures of gases, to try and analyze what actual physical result would we expect if you were to introduce certain particulates into the atmosphere, certain aerosols. And the paper is entitled A Global Warming Model, A Global Warming Model. I think that people will find that on the front page of, if they go to carnicum.com, I think they will see a link to that paper right away. It's true, it's a physical and mathematical model, and I'm not going to go into all the details of that. There is a separate paper. If people read that, they'll see a separate paper where they can see the development of the model. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I'm saying, it represents a reasonable attempt to, for the first time, quantify what the expect of this would be.
Okay.
And I really didn't know what to expect, only theoretically that it should heat it up. But how much? And so what are the main factors here that would be expected to affect such a model? Well, one of them would be what it is that you're putting into the air, okay, what material you're putting in. This model has chosen barium, the element of barium, as the material of introduction. How much you put in the air, would be a factor. And so this model will have a variable or factor in it that is one of concentration. And we'll give some sense of scale of that. And then another variable would be how long this material is existing in the atmosphere.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
And another variable would be how much energy is going into the system. Basically, in this case, solar insulation, solar radiation coming in.
Right.
That's another variable, is if you're putting energy in, how would it affect it? And the final result that the model will attempt to portray would be the actual temperature rise in the atmosphere. In this case, it's approached from what's called a differential standpoint, but the rise in the temperature of a uniform mass of air.
Okay,
that's the construct of the model.
All right, we'll look at that in just a moment. It sounds extraordinary. Again, unprecedented work by Clifford Carnicom as we continue. Let's get right back to our conversation with Clifford Carnicom. Go ahead, Clifford. I want to hear this model and what it turned up for you.
Thanks, Jeff. For those that are willing to look at this page that we're talking about, they will, in the end, at the top of it, see a graph. This is a three-dimensional graph that embodies what you and I just spoke of as certain variables, and they will see one axis will be entitled the concentration levels. Another will be entitled a time. That will be measured in years. And the third axis will be that of temperature change or temperature rise.
It's right now, at the top of Carnicom.com. It's called Global Warming Model. All right? That's where
now,
we are.
I also want to mention that this model, I have truthfully attempted as best I can to be conservative. In other words, when you develop models, it's better to try to err on the safe side in most cases. I mean, you can go after extreme cases if you want.
Sure.
But if you're trying to be relatively conservative in your approach and not overstate the case, my purpose here is to raise an issue. That was the first purpose of the very first paper, is to raise an issue. Say, you know, something doesn't fit there in terms of what some people are being allowed to say freely and openly without really providing any case for it or documentation or substantiation for, especially the great amount of attention given to Edward Teller and his paper, which we could just discuss further if and when we had time, but it just doesn't fit. And so I've tried to actually be very conservative in this model. And one example of that, two ways I can say that. One would be the amount of energy coming into the system. I've tried not to overstate that.
Mm-hmm.
If people look for peak values coming into the Earth, you're talking about roughly 1,000 watts per square meter coming in from the sun. My number is dropped down to the average, which tries to consider the effects of clouds, nighttime, the whole thing. And, you know, that number has dropped down to, I think, it's something like 366. In other words, I'm using the lowest number that I can, which appears to represent a reasonable representation of the amount of energy coming into the system. Another example would be on this concentration, and that's a big one. And I will say, there may be more going on here than I'm even saying, folks, is what it amounts to. But if you actually look at that graph where it labels says concentration of aerosolized barium in the lower atmosphere, micrograms per cubic meter. Well, let's get that one in the scale, because this brings up our friends the EPA again. Okay? The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, they have air quality standards. They have actual standards and limits that are supposed to be enforced as to air quality.
All right.
And if you look at that history over time, you have two main divisions, very small particles and particles a little bit bigger. The actual dividing line is 2.5 microns. My interest here is in the extremely small particles, less than 2.5 microns. They'll call it PM2.5. But nevertheless, they have some standards on how much of the stuff that is of a certain size is allowed into the sky and still meet all our air quality standards. Well, that number was 75 micrograms per cubic meter. Now, that's a number, and I know we get lost with numbers sometimes, but just call it's a certain amount. There's so much that's allowed in the atmosphere, and roughly a decade or a decade and a half ago, that number was on the order of 75 micrograms per cubic meter. Now, by the way, go back two decades and think about your air quality, okay, and what was it like back then? What could you see when the standards were at 75 micrograms per cubic meter? Well, before this stuff started, you could see pretty well. In a clear sky, you could see 120 miles.
Yeah, you could.
Okay. You see, I had the Santa Fe Mountains here the other day. They're 3 miles away from town, and I could barely see through them.
That bad,
terrible, just terrible. You know, so recall what it was like with those standards. Now, push ahead, and the more recent standards as of the last few years has been 50. They supposedly dropped the limit to 50. So here's the problem you're going to run into. If supposedly the standard was being dropped, then you would expect the air quality to be improving.
Certainly should.
If those standards were being enforced, correct?
Big if.
Okay, but not happening. Not happening. So at that point, you'll see me writing, 3 or 4 years ago, calling into question whether or not the standards are being enforced in any way, because the numbers I'm ending up with is that the concentration levels are quite likely at that level or greater already, even at that point. I was looking at numbers on the order of 50. I have actually one up to 96 micrograms. That may be too much. I don't know. But the point was I was calling into attention. It doesn't look like these standards are being enforced, even though they exist.
Right.
Now, just as I was writing this paper, it was really quite a surprise to me, but I found another paper just issued. It was a matter of a week or two before I wrote this paper. This was written in April of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it say? It says the EPA has dropped it down to 35 micrograms as the future standard. So the policies state that we are striving towards some improved standard.
Talks cheap.
But the physical reality is that the situation is deteriorating in a very real and substantial way. Now, if you look at my graph, again, trying to be conservative, if you see what I've done, I have allowed a maximum in my graph of up to 10 micrograms of this particular element, and I'm allowing it to start at zero. And I'm stepping it from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 micrograms. In other words, I'm using a number which is on the order of maybe a maximum of, a few percentage points or 10%. You know, and a representative of mine would be about 5 micrograms. So we're talking roughly 10% of what is allowed to be up there. And I'm questioning what would happen if that was there. So obviously there are big questions here as to whether or not standards actually are being enforced, and all of the observations and data, as well as what we know, the corruption and history is what's gone on with the EPA lately. You know, they've destroyed their records, they've destroyed their library. Everything says that these standards are not being adhered to, and it looks like we have flagrant violations of the very standards that are here to protect us.
We have outrageous violations. I completely concur. Stand by, we'll pause and come right back. I hope you're listening really carefully to this. It's as good as you're ever going to hear. We'll be right back with Clifford Carnicom in just a few minutes. Hi, we continue our conversation with Clifford Carnicom and a global warming model. Unprecedented research being done by the public sector, as it were, and led by Clifford. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We're talking about this global warming model. We've been over the factors that are into it. The point has been made that this model is intentionally and deliberately a conservative model. I'm allowing for things roughly on the order of 10% of the federal air standards being attributed to these introduced aerosols. I would consider that a rather modest approach.
Consider it extremely modest and conservative,
Based upon what we see. But the model will handle whatever we want to put into it, if and when that comes to pass. So the question is, what's the result? That's always the part that interests us, and of course it interested me too, but it took a while to get to. I honestly did not know what to expect here. But here's what happened. If you take this very, let's say, conservative, representative approach to what I'm doing here, if you use a number of 5 micrograms per cubic meter of this introduced material, and you allow that material to be in the atmosphere for a period of 20 years, again, a very, very conservative
model. Conservative, yeah. At that size of an item, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you do that, this model would show a rise in temperature of the lower atmosphere of roughly 1 degree in Fahrenheit. Now, for those...
That's 5 micrograms only, excuse me, 5 micrograms per cubic meter of air, atmosphere, all right. That's an awfully small amount. Yeah.
For people that are starting to become aware of this global warming issue and some of the models that are out there, you'll find that when we first hear these statements, like it rises at a degree or 2 degrees, most of us have the reaction, I think, at least many of us do, that,
not much.
A degree.
Right.
Yeah, what's a big deal in a degree, okay? But in the physics of this planet, a degree change in temperature is a huge deal. And people, if they want to just look into it a little bit, and you'll find if you start raising the temperature of the planet 1 degree, you're changing everything in a huge way. And you start getting to 1 to 3 degrees, really big things are happening. Now, I'm going to make reference here to, this is from a book that I had that was actually written in 1997. Okay, it's 10 years old. All right, and here's what the guy said back then. This is Crutzen again. Crutzen was the Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, and he has a Scientific American book out. Here's his stuff written in 1997. He says, conservative estimates of global planetary surface temperature change are in the order of 1 to 3 degrees centigrade over a 50-year interval. And here's what he says. He says, this temperature change will produce sea level changes in the order of 10 to 30 centimeters. And here's a statement. It is stated, furthermore, that much of the Earth's population would find it inordinately difficult to adjust to such changes. This was a 1997 model.
Pretty diplomatically stated. He's talking about catastrophe here.
Very much so. Now, that's 1997. If you fast forward to something that I've added as a footnote on this paper, they already have the data coming in already at 1.5 times those projections, okay? So a degree is a huge deal, and this model indicates a degree with a very, very low concentration over a period of roughly a couple decades. It is not difficult to project what if, first of all, the point is that's enough. That alone is enough that should be raising some serious concern, because this model is indicating that these introduced particulates, okay, would already be on par with all known effects that people are attributing to the global warming issue. In other words, the magnitude from this model indicates it's already on par with the supposed sources of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
One can only project that. What if more, let's say, intense numbers and shorter time periods were used? What would be the effect then? And this is the lead-in now to another paper that I want to mention. There's actually two. I'll try to get through one. Again, I want to attribute this to the participants on the message board as bringing this to my attention, because it really blew my mind when I saw this thing, because it's basically, for what, 10 years, the public outcry has been, folks, you've been screwing up our air and polluting it, and we want it stopped, and we want to know what it is. For 10 years, the public has been doing this, meaning nothing but denial and ridicule and attempted marginalization along the way and refusal to investigate. That's the pattern of history for 10 years. What happens as of May 3rd of this year? NASA issues a paper. It's a very interesting paper. And when we discuss this, Jeff, I know it's not such a cool thing to read on the air, so I'm only asking permission to read 2 lines, I think it is.
Clifford, read as much as you want, please.
From this paper, hesitate. If it's okay with you. But,
it's fine.
This is a paper issued by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration on May 3rd, and it's from the Goddard Flight Center. First of all, here's the title. Take the title along. The title of this paper is Widespread Twilight Zone. Twilight Zone is in quotation marks. Widespread Twilight Zone detected around clouds. Now, remember what has happened to the public outcry for a decade, and now listen to what we have from NASA telling us the following. This comes from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and they say, Goddard Space Flight Center documents for the first time that air around clouds that was previously considered clear is actually filled with particles that are neither cloud droplets nor typical dry aerosols such as dust and air pollution. Worldwide, up to 60% of the atmosphere labeled as cloud-free in satellite observations is actually filled with this twilight zone of in-between particles.
Now, again, these are not typical pollution particles from the ground.
Now, you had this article on your site, I believe.
I certainly did.
This is just astounding. You have, you know, we need NASA now to tell us what we've been telling them for over a decade.
That's right.
And they now need to tell us that there's something out there that's never been discovered before in the history of humankind, that is this incredible mystery, that there is suddenly, there's just all these darn unidentified aerosols up there, and we have no idea what they are or where they came from, and they cover 60% of the planet. And it's just this amazing thing, and we're here to offer it to you as our discovery.
Yeah, I read it. I was disgusted when I saw it. I ran it. I'm glad you're here to talk about it, because it's vile.
It is vile. It is vile, and I thank you for that word, because the public should be offended in the deepest sense. They do not need NASA to tell them this. NASA is not telling them anything they don't know, and it's the public's job to put NASA in its place. And to our first thing to do is you get these things immediately identified in detail. What are these mystery aerosols?
All they got to do, folks, is go up and collect samples. It won't take them but one day to get samples and begin the analysis. Hold on, we'll be right back. Okay, let's get right back to our guest, Clifford Carnahan. Go ahead, Clifford, because we're running out of time, and I'd certainly right now invite you back at your earliest convenience to continue with tonight's agenda if you'd like. So it's certainly up to you. I'm here for you. So go ahead now, please.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I'll try to get in what we can here at least. And one more point on this article then. If you read the article a little bit further, you'll read that they're saying, our models for global warming, it just looks like they may have some problems. And with this brand new discovery, we're going to have to consider these mystery aerosols in our model. Our models just may be off with respect to global warming.
It's bald-faced lying, folks. Bald-faced liars is what they're doing.
Which is exactly the point of the previous discussion. The model that I presented says that it should heat up, and it'll give you an idea how much it should heat up. And NASA is not needing to come around and tell you what you already know, see. That you can see this material heating up the atmosphere. You can feel it. Look at the moisture pattern. So they're not your guardians and saviors here. It's the public. We are the inhabitants and guardians and custodians of the planet. And it is our job to take ownership of that. There's another article here, again, another person on the message board. I'm going to mention this guy's name because he's been on there for so long. It's not a personal name, but he goes by the name of Sore Throat, and I want to give that fellow credit because for years this person has been posting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds articles and scientific documents on current events.
Excellent.
And the title of this one that he put up just literally yesterday or the day or so ago is called What? NASA, it's from NASA, Danger Point Closer Than Thought from Warming. And what's their key sentence here? It says, with just 10 more years of business as usual, it becomes impractical to avoid disastrous effects. This is coming from NASA also. Okay, mm-hmm. This one is by Hansen, who many of us know, I think has received a lot of attention because of his treatment by the administration, this type of thing, if I've got the name right. But basically, you know, I'm saying I have this very conservative model, right, to try to not overstate the case. You already have the data coming out 1.5 greater times than the models of 10 years ago, and now you have them coming out and saying, hey, folks, we're not dealing with, you know, decades and centuries. We're talking about 10 years. At what point do you feel you have a stake in the ownership of this planet? You're talking about a decade in this paper where they're saying the game's over, guys.
Not we're in trouble or we might be in trouble. It's going to be terminal.
You know, the public is trying to do their part. I understand that. And I don't have the answer, but it is our planet. It is our ownership.
Not according to the men and women in the hallowed halls of Congress, for the most part, Clifford. They don't represent their constituents at all. You know that? I know that.
And people will have to decide what form of representation it's going to take. But I wanted to make this point on the global warming that there appears to be an intentional misrepresentation of the issue over the last 10 years, and stories like this from NASA appear to me to be just a cover in a sense of trying to maintain ownership and authority over the issue when they have none, and they deserve none. They have not responded. NASA has issued as many ridiculing papers as anybody.
Agreed.
On this subject. So there's no way out for them at this time. They're culpable as can be. The last two things, I know we're going to run out of time. I wanted to leave people with a couple of things to listen to. I don't watch TV now, have not for several years, any main sense. But I do listen to the radio quite a bit. Now, I'm told that what I'm going to speak of exists on the television also in a big way. I just don't know of it. But I want to pass it on for people to at least listen to. And what's happening is I'm noticing, you remember at the beginning of this these events that you had this 1-800 I got flu? Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where you had these radio commercials come out saying, call this 800 number.
Sure.
1-800 I got flu and report, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it was a tracking mechanism. It was one of the earlier tracking mechanisms. Well, I want to mention two things that have happened recently that catch my attention, and they're under the guise of what you would call a public service announcement. One of them will be for the topic of what's called COPD. The other one will be with respect to lung cancer. Now, on this COPD, this is what I hear. People can see if I'm right or not, but I hear it coming from the National Institute of Health. And eventually tied into the drug companies, apparently, because they're recommending that people go to their doctors and get treatment. But here's what they're saying. They're saying that, you know, we have this new disease out there, and we're giving it a name, and we're calling this thing COPD. And they're saying, did you know that COPD is the fourth leading cause of death now? Now, they never actually tell you what COPD is. But it stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is what it stands for. Mm-hmm. And if people look back at the evolution of this thing, they will see that I wrote a paper about 3 years ago where that term was used for the first time coalesce and embody numerous diseases related to respiratory ailments. It combined them into one, such things as asthma and respiratory problems. And they coined this new phrase. And this now becomes... Now at the fourth leading cause of death, it was the eighth, okay? Or those sources were in the eighth, and now they're combined in this category that's a fourth. Now, they never tell you what COPD is during the ad. They tell you that it's just this huge problem that's affecting the entire population. They don't tell you where it's coming from. They never get a source for it, mm-hmm. But they tell you what the primary symptom is. You know what the primary symptom is?
Death.
Shortness of breath. Shortness of breath is your primary symptom from this disease,
uh-huh.
That they never identify where it comes from or why it is suddenly on the increase.
Yeah.
but that you should go to your doctor and get treatment for the COPD thing, because you may have it.
Right. Yeah, it's ludicrous. Ludicrous. Have you heard the on-air PSAs by Bush Sr. and William Jefferson Clinton urging people to pay attention and be prepared because we may have another cataclysm, a catastrophe anytime?
I have not heard that.
Oh, yeah, it's on there. I played it on the air. Judy Andreas phoned in and played it for us about a week ago or so. Yeah, they're a dynamic duo urging the public to get prepared.
This title, The Twilight Zone, I mean, it's apt. You know, we're in the Twilight Zone.
You bet we are.
We're in the Twilight Zone.
That NASA paper was the most disturbing thing I've seen in many, many years, Clifford. It really bothered me. All of a sudden, they discover something that profound.
Yeah.
And, my God, how many satellites do they have up? How many monitoring stations have they scattered around the world? They know exactly what's going on.
They've had look at all the aerosol programs. There's thousands of aerosol monitoring programs I can cite for you if we need to.
That's
they
right.
talk about having these fancy filters. You can go put a red filter yourself from a camera and you can see this stuff. You know, the next one on our way out here is another public service announcement. And, you know, what happened here was when I brought this up to somebody, what I was talking about in COPD, and somebody asked me, well, you know, is there anything going on with cancer? Lung cancer on this, and at the time I said, well, you know, I haven't really heard anything to that nature. I honestly don't know. Darned if a week later, 2 weeks later, I'm hearing another public service announcement, and this one is talking about how lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer, and it just continues to increase and increase and increase. And again, they never say why, and in fact, they even make the point, they say, you know, and smoking is even going down, which we know it is, of course, right? Smoking is not the factor there, but they say smoking is even going down, but darn it, lung cancer is really, it just keeps increasing.
That's the number one form of cancer now, lung cancer?
Apparently, yeah, that's the way they were talking on this that I heard. But the important thing, they were not giving a source.
They were not giving a source,
but they're telling you this is the main health risk that you're facing.
Well, you see, that's a lie of omission. It's desensitizing people to reality and a cause when there's an effect. It's a disconnect game they're playing.
And I can only say, I hope it's not effective. I mean, that's our job. I'm asking you to look at what this stuff is. Just take it simple with pollution. If you can't handle the other stuff, get the pollution in the sky stopped. And if you're having shortness of breath, and more people are dying around you from respiratory ailments, when you've all quit your smoking, then ask yourself, why is that happening?
All right, Clifford, I need to...
way that I can put it this time.
Yeah, you've stated it brilliantly. Your best guesstimate, the Twilight Zone, the upper atmosphere pollution, the particulates... We could probably guess pretty much what they are, primarily coming from aerosol spray operations, not from the ground, not heavy diesel emissions, not that.
You have a mystery source of aerosols that we don't know about, you know, for 60 years of monitoring the other atmosphere that's covering 60% of the planet.
They know everything, and they're lying, and they've been lying from the beginning. They know it all.
You know, but the public... You know, need to stop playing their game. They don't need to follow the lead from these people. The people are the lead.
Used to be that way long ago, once upon a time. And unless it changes, unless it reverts back to that, we might as well march into the prison camps.
You know, I'll keep pushing it the best that I can. And also, this is a little side note. This just happened literally last night, a small item. But I'm watching this documentary that I got from the library here. It's a PBS documentary. It's called Avoiding Armageddon. And it was produced in 2003, Walter Cronkite, Ted Turner production. And I just have started the first one there. But the first one is on, you know, biological and chemical experimentation. And if people think that they still have, if they still cannot think that this issue is real and that such things are done, namely the introduction of foreign materials into your atmosphere for a broad myriad of purposes, take a look at this documentary and you'll see direct documentation by date, by Walter Cronkite, right, the voice you could trust, right, that will tell you the dates, names of the programs, where they were doing what. They were using aircraft to distribute aerosols over the population without their consent.
It's all a matter of record.
It's all there. It's all there. It doesn't matter what we're going to do about it.
Hidden in plain view, Clifford, as they say. Thank you, sir, again, as always, over all these years for your magnificent work. And you want to come back on the program, you just let me know, and we can't thank you enough.
Yep, I thank you very much for everything you're doing. I really appreciate it.
Okay, good night, Clifford.
Yeah, bye-bye now.
Clifford Carnicom. And, the high-altitude spraying, folks, has begun to pay off horrendous dividends. We'll be back in 21 hours.